Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. How did Germany go from a democracy to a genocidal state? It happened to Germany over the span of just a few years. Today's guest, Sasha Pawlikow-Saransky, says we should study history in order to understand how we got to where we are. In his new book, Go Back to Where You Came From, he explains how xenophobia went mainstream. He says the greatest threat to liberal democracies comes from the far right, who exploit the fears of outsiders to chip away at the values and institutions that make our societies liberal. He writes, "The new right's greatest success has been to reframe the debate in stark cultural terms to the point that ideological cleavages over economic policy, foreign policy, and other issues that were long the bread and butter of political debate have almost disappeared from the discussion." Sasha Pawlikow-Saransky is an Open Society Foundations fellow, and we are waiting for him to arrive because he's currently in traffic. So in the meantime, we're going to play you a clip from Marine Le Pen, who lost the French election. But many argue that this does not mean that the tide is turning. So here's a clip from Marine Le Pen.
But Marine has distanced herself from her father since 2015. In part, that's because she has tried to change the message of the party and change the branding of the party.
I excluded from the National Front my very own father. We could not tolerate words, unacceptable words, that would lead to a caricature of our movement.
By removing her father, Le Pen hoped to move the party away from anti-Semitism. But a recent comment has undercut those efforts. Speaking to the press, Marine Le Pen denied that France was responsible for the Ville d'Yves roundup, which took place when French authorities arrested Jews and brought them to the Vélodrome d'Hiver indoor cycling track in Paris for eventual delivery to Nazi concentration camps.
Son discours sur le Ville d'Yves.
Je pense que la France n'est pas responsable du Ville d'Yves. Voilà.
She said this despite the fact that French President Jacques Chirac formally acknowledged guilt on behalf of the French state in 1995. By questioning French culpability in the Holocaust, her comments have reopened old wounds. But for the time being, Le Pen remains a leading contender, as she has been throughout the campaign, and that's largely due to her successful efforts to rebrand the National Front. Instead of being seen as anti-Semites, Le Pen has worked to portray the party as protectors of French identity and French values.
Et notamment aux gens de toutes origines et de toutes confessions que nous avons accueillis. Je rappelle, parce que cela va sans dire, mais cela va mieux en le disant, il n'y a pas et il n'y aura pas d'autres lois et valeurs en France que françaises.
Her big thing is about, you know, France for the French, which gets into some of her policies, which actually we would perceive as racist or xenophobic, but she sees them as returning to a sort of mythical France. In a way, it reminds us a little bit of Trump.
The forgotten men and women of our country will be forgotten no longer.
I am very happy about the election of Donald Trump. I think that the United States will once again regain its former image in the world, which had become very damaged.
To Marine Le Pen, there is a certain French culture that should be upheld, and that's being lost in the tide of globalization. She's particularly anti-globalization. She's against the European Union, and she would like to radically reduce the number of immigrants.
We're not going to welcome any more people. Stop. We're full up.
During the 2015 refugee...
That is a clip from Vox, published in 2017, April of 2017. Today's guest, journalist Sasha Pawlikow-Saransky, writes in his new book, Go Back to Where You Came From, that unlike her incendiary father, Marine Le Pen ran a disciplined political operation and has proven that her party can win half of the vote or more in regions from the Côte d'Azur in the south, where she took 49%, to Pas-de-Calais in the north, where she won a 52% majority. She and her Danish and Dutch counterparts are not unreconstructed fascists or inconsequential extremists with fringe ideas lacking popular appeal. A lot of people argue that they are, and we'll talk about that with today's guest. Sasha Polakow-Saransky is an Open Society Foundations Fellow. He was an op-ed editor at the New York Times and a senior editor at Foreign Affairs. He is also the author of The Unspoken Alliance, Israel's Secret Relationship with Apartheid South Africa, and he's speaking about his new book, Go Back to Where You Came From, right after this show at noon at the Commonwealth Club here in San Francisco, 110 The Embarcadero. And Sasha joins me in studio. Hi, Sasha. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. When you started this book in 2015, you write that you did not think the rise of the far right in the U.S. and Europe would happen so quickly. But so much has happened in the last 2 years.
Yes, it moved much faster than I thought it would. And in this country, things happened that I never would have expected. I went into this project focused on France and Germany and Holland and Denmark. And as I was starting the research, there was a huge influx of refugees from Syria that summer. And I started to follow some of the refugees who were coming from Syria into Turkey and into the Greek islands and moving up through Europe. But what I was really interested in was the backlash against them and the politics within these countries and how politicians exploited the presence of refugees and the large numbers of refugees in order to stoke the anger and resentment and xenophobia of their own populations. And I think that these politicians, like Le Pen, like Wilders, and like the Danish People's Party in Denmark, it was a great gift for them because they were already pushing an anti-Islam xenophobic agenda for years before this happened. But suddenly there were lots of people coming into Europe and they could point to them and say, these are terrorists, when in fact these were refugees fleeing ISIS terrorists in Syria for the most part. But what they managed to do is they conflated the two groups and they basically said, the Muslims are coming, they're going to take over our culture and civilization, and they're a threat to us. And they also combined that with what I consider a fairly savvy economic policy, which was to try and poach voters from the old left, from the Communist Party in France, from the Social Democratic Party in Denmark, from the Labour Party in Holland. And what they did is these parties that always had an anti-immigrant nativist agenda started to combine that with an economic policy that said, we support the welfare state, but for us and no one else. And we're not going to share our hard-won benefits and our childcare and our healthcare and our free secondary education with anyone else. And it resonated with people who were angry, and they stoked that resentment with this fear of Muslims and combined the two things. And unfortunately, it was politically successful. And I think that that is the real challenge for the left and for all of us who want to push back against this agenda, is how do you win those people back that these far-right parties seduced with a combination of xenophobia and a sort of nativist economic policy in defense of the welfare state?
Whenever we do shows about the refugee crisis and ISIS always comes up, we talk about this so-called war on terror and Western intervention in the Middle East. It doesn't get as much attention as I wish it did in this country. I mean, you even had the New York Times Baghdad bureau chief Tim Orengo telling Fresh Air that if it weren't for the U.S. invading Iraq, ISIS probably wouldn't exist. But you just don't have deep conversations in this country about that. What about these three countries and the media? Are they talking about what happens after the West intervenes? And, I mean, there's so many issues why people are leaving. Failed states, corrupt governments, climate change. But Western intervention is a huge part of it. Is this discussed in these countries?
Well, it does come up. In Denmark, the question of Afghanistan was part of the foreign policy debate because the Danes actually supplied some troops to the NATO mission in Afghanistan. The Syria issue does come up, but it's not on the scale of the U.S., the way that these countries have been involved. The French sell a huge amount of arms to various Middle Eastern countries and are involved in that respect. And so it does come up, but it's not the central issue in these debates. Somehow it gets elided and blurred in the way that you're describing, and people tend to forget that the actions or inactions of some of these governments have actually had a direct impact on some of these refugee flows. I would say also on the question of intervention or non-intervention in Syria that there is a debate to be had about whether the United States should have done something at some stage earlier in Syria before the Russians came in and started bombing and supporting the Assad regime. And the refugee flows out of Syria have been even more dramatic since that Russian intervention. So, you know, I think that we need to talk about the aftermath of the Iraq War and the knock-on effects and aftershocks in the region, but we should also be willing to talk about what could have been done and was never done that may have protected some of these people.
Mm. Why did you decide to write this book and focus on France, Germany, and Holland specifically?
Part of it is personal. I've lived in those countries and have family in some of them. I'd done reporting there before. I was in Denmark as a teenager in high school when the Danish People's Party was just starting to emerge as a political force. And so I continued to follow it in the early part of my career as a journalist because I was interested in them as a far-right party that was trying to put on a friendly face and to rebrand themselves as a new sort of conservative movement, distancing themselves from the old far right. I found that interesting. And the quote that you read earlier that I know some people will disagree with, I think is very important and has to be reckoned with. Marine Le Pen is not her father. She is dangerous. She's a nativist. She's scary. And her ideas for where she would like to take France are terrifying. But she has made a real effort to purge the party of some of these overt neo-Nazis who were part of it. Some of them are still around, I would argue, but the political impact of this rebranding is what interests me because that's what is drawing new voters to these parties. And I think that if people on the left just say, fascist, 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 you're just like your father, you're nothing but a Nazi, then they fail to draw these voters back because what they're doing now is much more sophisticated, I think. They're not just a bunch of skinheads marching in the street with swastikas. The Danish People's Party, for instance, has all along since the mid-1990s dissociated themselves from skinhead movements. Denmark was occupied by the Nazis. It's not a popular position on the right in Denmark to be a Nazi skinhead. And so the right has sort of found this other space where they can hate immigrants and call for refugees to be sent home or not let in with impunity. But as soon as you cross a line into saying anything that would sound supportive of the Nazis, that wouldn't fly in Denmark. If you look at Germany and this new party there, the AfD, there's a member of that party, Björn Höcke, who called the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin a monument of shame. So there's overt Nazism in some of these parties or sympathies for it. And to my knowledge, he still hasn't been purged from the party, although they were discussing it. Mm-hmm. So I think that if we're going to fight back against this agenda and this trend, it's very important to see how these parties are trying to change their image and how that's manipulating voters.
The line you referred to that I read in the intro when you were writing about Marine Le Pen, you say she and her Danish and Dutch counterparts are not, as some on the left would like to believe, unreconstructed fascists or inconsequential extremists with fringe ideas lacking unpopular appeal.
Right. They're certainly not on the fringe anymore because their ideas have moved into the mainstream. And that's really the topic of this whole book is how did these ideas that used to be on the fringe and should be pushed back to the fringe, how did they get into the mainstream? And so they're not inconsequential either because she won, as you were saying, as I came on the show, 52% of the vote in northern France and a third of the vote nationally, which is double what her father got in 2002. So I think we have to recognize that they've rebranded and changed their image. They have pushed out some of the nastiest and most unsavory people, but their ideas are still dangerous, and you don't have to be an unreconstructed Nazi skinhead to be dangerous. And so let's talk about the threat as it is and address it and try to push them back to the fringes where they belong.
The majority of your book focuses on France, Germany, and Holland. But there are very striking parallels to what we're seeing right here in the United States. What would you say are the most striking parallels? What really stood out for you?
Well, I think the Trump campaign depended on a very similar kind of rhetoric. He tried to opportunistically manipulate voters and their resentments and their anger and direct all of that towards a new scapegoat, which in this case was immigrants, Muslims, and any sort of foreigner who he describes as a threat to this country. So if you look at the campaign rhetoric about Mexican rapists, if you look at the attacks on judges during the campaign and the independence of our judiciary in this country, if you look at his rhetoric during the travel ban early in the administration and his defense of it in the months since then, all of this is about keeping Americans safe from the threat from outside, when in fact most of the people who he is trying to keep out, and as of 2 days ago with the revision of the travel ban and these 11 countries that are still going to be subjected to greater review, he's essentially keeping out desperate refugees who might be sitting ducks in target practice for ISIS or for Assad's Air Force while they sit and wait to be vetted to come into the United States. And as you know, the vetting procedures for refugees are already incredibly stringent. Most approved refugees in countries like Syria and Iraq wait for about 2 years. They're vetted by intelligence, they're vetted by diplomats before they get to come. And so these people have already passed through a security check. And to me, it seems like a gratuitous gesture to appease nativist and xenophobic base, and unfortunately the result is likely to be that some of these people will die while they're waiting.
What did you hear when you did interviews in Europe about Donald Trump and what's happening here in the U.S. from the right?
They love him. I recall a conversation with two anti-immigration activists who run a shady group called Retake Calais in the city of Calais, where there was a large refugee camp known as the Jungle before it got bulldozed by the French authorities last year. And there were, at any given time, between 3,000 and 6,000 migrants and refugees there trying to move north into England, either through the tunnel or on a train or by jumping on trucks. And they would stay in this camp. And there was a backlash movement in the city. And these guys were sitting in a park with me telling me how the Muslims were threatening French civilization and coming to replace them. But they also said, we love Donald Trump so much. He tells it like it is. He's even better than Marine Le Pen. And we wish we had someone like that here. We'll probably vote for Le Pen, but Trump's really got balls and he tells it like it is. Mm-hmm. That's what I heard from them. Same thing in Holland. In Denmark, the Danish People's Party is always trying to put on a moderate face, and they are preparing themselves to one day be in government, so they were a little bit more reluctant to openly endorse Trump, but they certainly share a lot of his ideas. That said, politicians like Geert Wilders in Holland came to the Republican convention, appeared alongside people like Milo Yiannopoulos and Pamela Geller, and were praised as the great saviors of Western civilization at a pro-Trump rally. So Wilders has absolutely no problem praising Trump and endorsing everything he stands for.
Can you give us more information about the direct connections between these far-right leaders in Europe and the far-right in the United States?
So the connections are often difficult to establish. The Republican convention story I just told you is one of the more obvious ones. Wilders came as an honored guest. Nigel Farage, the leader of the UKIP former leader of the UKIP party and the face of the Brexit movement in the UK last year, was a frequent guest of Trump on the campaign trail and at Trump Tower and praised by him. So there is some direct contact. But what I'm more interested in is the movement of ideas and the cross-pollination of ideas, because the ideas are very similar in these places. And ultimately, that's what matters, because that's what is motivating people to vote for these politicians. So they are talking to each other. And Le Pen and Wilders and the German AfD party, they had a convention last year in Germany that most of them were present at. They have occasional conferences. But what's really important is the fact that they're pushing similar ideas in all of these places, and it's bringing similar kinds of voters into the fold. And I think that that's where the similarities become most interesting, because Trump's rhetoric in the campaign, I come from Michigan originally, and Trump won Michigan narrowly, a state that Obama won by 10%, against Romney, who's the son of the former governor of Michigan. What happened in these places? What happened in the sort of post-industrial suburbs of Detroit? What happened in places like Wisconsin? I think that these are important questions for the left and for the Democratic Party to ask as we move forward, because it's very similar to the voters I met who used to vote Communist Party in northern France. They're saying similar things, and they're voting for nativist politicians. And I think that there's a tendency and often an impulse on the left, including among my own friends and family, to denounce these people and say, oh, they're all incorrigible racists and we don't want to have anything to do with them. And I think that politically that's dangerous, because ultimately some of these people are the voters that the left is going to need to win back if they're going to defeat people like Trump, if they're going to defeat people like Wilders and Le Pen. And Wilders and Le Pen didn't win in Europe, of course, but their ideas have won on many levels. And when your ideas win and all the other parties try to emulate your ideas and copy your ideas, then essentially your political agenda becomes the mainstream political agenda. And that's what we're seeing.
Today we're speaking with journalist Sasha Polakow-Saransky, author of Go Back to Where You Came From, The Backlash Against Immigration and the Fate of Western Democracy. And he writes extensively about what is happening in Europe on the right and connects it to what's happening here in the United States, focuses really on France, Germany, and Holland. And if you have any questions or comments about what is happening overseas and here in the U.S., we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. When Sasha began writing his book in 2015, he did not think the rise of the far right in the Europe and the U.S. would happen so quickly. But here we are. And like he said, even though some of these far right politicians are not winning overseas, they are coming very, very close. 866-798-8255. You can also tweet at Your Call Radio, or you can leave us a comment, yourcallradio.org. You focus on Michigan and some of these other states, and we're still talking about how this happened. I mean, there are many, many layers to all of this. I mean, you even had Union Obama supporters voting for Trump. And I remember watching a video with Bernie Sanders speaking to Union Trump supporters. And by the end of the night, he had them clapping for health care for all and free college education and raising the Social Security cap. Of course, why wouldn't they? I mean, they're middle class people who are actually struggling. Do you see those similarities in these countries?
Absolutely. I think that your example is a telling one, because it shows how the absence of an economic policy agenda in the mainstream Democratic Party circles in this country has left this open space. And Trump has come in and filled that void on some level. And Le Pen has done something similar in France. And if I had a copy of the book in front of me, I could read to you from it. I'll keep talking while I try to find it. But, you know, there's a quote from Le Pen, where she essentially, if you didn't know that it was her speaking, you might think that this is Bernie Sanders. Let me read to you here. This is from an interview I did with Marine Le Pen in May of 2016. And although she prefers to avoid the phrase welfare state, that's a socialist concept, she told me, she's appealed directly to a yearning for a large nurturing state that fights for the little guy and not the rich. I defend fraternity, the idea that a developed country should be able to provide the poorest with the minimum needed to live with dignity as a human being. The French state no longer does that, she told me. We're in a world today in which you either defend the interests of the people or the interests of the banks. So that's Marine Le Pen. And you can understand, if you're an unemployed former Communist Party voter in some post-industrial wasteland in the northern part of France, and you hear this rhetoric, and meanwhile the Socialist Party is just saying the same thing that they've been saying for the last 20 years. And if a new candidate like Macron comes along and is also talking about a centrist economic agenda and has a background in investment banking, and then you hear Le Pen say that and you say, okay, maybe that makes sense. Maybe she's the only one who's fighting for me. And I should mention that in France there was another force in this election who does come out of the Communist Party, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, and he did get a lot of that far-left vote in the first round of the election, but he was eliminated. And when it came down to the final two candidates, a lot of these former far-left voters went for Le Pen because she was the only one making that economic argument. And so just to go back to what I was saying earlier, that sometimes people who don't buy the xenophobic nativist agenda will hear something in the economic messaging that these politicians are putting out. And if that resonates, they may set aside their reservations. Not everyone operates this way. I certainly don't operate this way as a voter, and you probably don't either. But you can understand that some people might hear this message and find some appeal in it. And if they're frustrated with the same old candidates, then they go for it. And so I also think that we need to look at these parties and these politicians and see how they've done it. That's quite a remarkable thing that Le Pen has done, that she's able to attract ex-communists and also a lot of gay voters, a lot of feminist voters, and even some Jewish voters, which is alarming given the history of her party and her father's overt anti-Semitism. So this is a very well thought out strategy on their part, and they're trying very hard to get people who never would have considered voting for these parties to vote for them now. And I think that the real issue is that there's this void on the left, apart from people like Sanders, there's a reluctance to talk about these issues. And so you say Sanders got a crowd of Union Trump voters clapping. That's because he spoke to them on an economic policy agenda. Sanders didn't have any sort of nativist or anti-immigration agenda when he ran, but he still managed to get a lot of these people's votes, people who then went and voted for Trump in the general. So I think that there are a lot of questions to ask, and I don't have all the answers, but that is a major force in our politics right now. And I think that the solutions and the methods for winning back some of those voters will come from experimenting with new sorts of ideas and new sorts of economic messages that have not been part of the Democratic Party's mainstream agenda for a long time in this country.
Today we're speaking with journalist Sasha Polakow-Saransky about his new book, Go Back to Where You Came From, The Backlash Against Immigration and the Fate of Western Democracy. He'll be speaking about his book right after the show at noon at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, 110 The Embarcadero. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll speak with McClatchy's Ben Weider about why the United Arab Emirates is paying the Steve Bannon-linked firm Cambridge Analytica over $300,000 for a social media campaign against Qatar. We'll also be joined by San Francisco journalist Joe Eskenazi, who wrote the cover story for SF Public Press, which looks at how thousands of people remain homeless while rooms in SRO hotels are vacant. That is tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. If you'd like to join today's show, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What questions or comments do you have about the rise of the far right in Europe and here in the United States? You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We're joined today by journalist Sasha Polakow-Saransky, author of Go Back to Where You Came From, The Backlash Against Immigration and the Fate of Western Democracy. Let's hear from Mick in San Francisco. Hi, Mick. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for another great show and a great guest. I think your analysis is fantastic. I lived in France for 11 years, and, you know, between Mélenchon and Marine Le Pen, or Macron in the end, Mélenchon was just too far to the left for a lot of people, friends and family I know. What I think is missing, however, from egregiously from the analysis from you and from every shining light in the progressive or democratic party here, is the discourse around the mechanics of how we vote on machinery that's controlled by three companies, massive Republican Party donors, showing incredible anomalies since 2002 in the exit polls that our own State Department has used for a century around the world to verify elections. So we can't audit these machines. The software that counts the votes is off because of intellectual property rights, is off limits to independent auditors, and we have nothing but incredible red shifts consistently. And I've analyzed many election integrity experts, assessments, major universities. They cannot validate or legitimize these types of statistical anomalies, and it doesn't even represent a part of our discourse nationally. So I think instead of looking at this for very many legitimate reasons that you brought up as to shifting demographics and voting patterns, what we're missing from this analysis is how do we actually vote? Who's counting the votes? And the Russians may have been involved, and certainly like we've been in their elections for decades. But we're not looking at the elephant in the room, which is we don't control our own machinery or equipment anymore. And I think that is a big issue.
Thank you for that. And we will continue covering that. In fact, during the break, we were just talking about the fact that almost half the country in the United States does not vote. We have massive voter suppression. What are your thoughts about this and just the voting system in this country?
It worries me. I am not an expert on this, so I can't comment on it, but I do recall reading quite a lot of computer science experts in the weeks after the election when there was a recount effort in Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania talking about the potential flaws in the software and the potential pitfalls and certain parts of the software in these voting machines that could be exploited by Russians or anyone else who wanted to get into them. So I'm not a voting machine expert or a computer expert, but it does concern me. And I do wish that there was a simple paper trail for every vote. And I also think that we have an unusually decentralized voting system in this country. If you compare it to France or Germany or many of these other places where it's much more standardized and there's an easier way to track where the votes came from. And so I would absolutely support efforts to investigate and validate those and to move away from any sort of technology that doesn't leave a paper trail or have some sort of humanly verifiable vote paper trail.
Do people in these countries vote on electronic voting machines that are owned by private corporations?
I'm not sure where the voting machines come from, actually. I haven't looked into that. I do know that in many places, it's still quite a simple, basic ballot box where you put it in and it's hand-counted. Certainly the Brexit vote in the UK, I recall staying up all night that night, and there was actually a competition between constituencies to see who could count the votes the fastest. And they were shuttling actual boxes of paper ballots back and forth and hand-counting them and putting in their results. So certainly in that referendum in the UK, it was done in a very old-fashioned way.
To your point, Ari Berman wrote a cover story for Mother Jones. We're going to try to get him on in the next couple weeks, called Rigged, How Voter Suppression Threw Wisconsin to Trump. He writes, it possibly handed him the whole election. You know what's interesting, Sasha? Whenever we analyze what happened in November, and I can't believe next month it's going to be a year anniversary from the election, but some of our guests often say things like, half the country supports Trump, or half the country voted for Trump. Actually, a larger percentage of the country did not vote than voted for Trump. About 24% voted for Trump. I mean, it's just an interesting thing to put out there, because it's so easy just to say half the country voted for Trump, a little more voted for Hillary, and here we are. He won the Electoral College.
Yeah, it's a real shame that people stay home to such an extent. I mean, there are countries in the world like Australia with mandatory voting where you're actually fined if you don't vote. And their voting percentages hover around 80-85% most of the time. And Holland used to have mandatory voting. They don't anymore, to my knowledge, but they still are in the 70s in terms of voter participation. So I think there's a lot of apathy, and I understand why. In France, for instance, this election in the second round had the highest number of blank ballots. So people in France often don't stay home, but they submit a blank ballot as a protest vote. Mm-hmm. But they consider it a vote, and it was actually a concerted movement this time where people were writing op-eds and actually encouraging people to go to the polls and put a blank piece of paper in to show that they wanted to participate in the democratic process, but they didn't like either of the candidates. So I think that people should vote, and it opens the door for victories like Trump's if too many people stay home. And I think what you see in some of the data analysis coming out after the last election is that a lot of previous non-voters came out and voted for Trump this time because he spoke to their concerns in a way that politicians hadn't in past years. And some of the regular voters who usually had voted in prior elections stayed home.
What do you see in terms of governments in these countries supporting the far right? Because here in the U.S., you've got a couple Republicans ripping on Trump, especially right now, but they're still voting with him. They want tax cuts for the wealthy. They just got rid of a rule that would allow citizens to file class action lawsuits against banks. I mean, they're with him on policy. They just don't want him to tweet and say these reactionary things.
Yeah, it's interesting to see what's happening in the Republican Party now. I certainly give credit to John McCain and Jeff Flake and Bob Corker for speaking out. I do think that they're standing up for basic American constitutional values and that they're genuine in their criticism of Trump. But they're also all leaving, so there's no skin in the game. I mean, that's what's interesting about this, right? There's no one or hardly anyone in the Republican Party now who actually is up for re-election who's coming out and criticizing Trump forcefully. It's the people who are going to retire or not run again who are doing this. And so I wish there'd be a little bit more moral courage from the rest of the party. And as you say, it's convenient for them because they feel like if they get another Supreme Court justice like Gorsuch, or if they get their tax cuts, if they're able to pass laws that make it difficult for consumers and regular people to sue large corporations, they're basically getting the agenda that they set out for, and Trump is just sort of a vessel to achieve that. And so I think the only way that we're going to see a real shift in the Republican Party is if they start to fail, and that's already happened with healthcare, and it remains to be seen if it will happen with tax cuts, that maybe they will turn against Trump if they're not able to achieve that legislative agenda, because then he's somehow getting in their way. And, you know, I would be quite happy if they don't achieve their legislative agenda, but it would be interesting to see how it changes the internal party dynamics, because I think that a lot of these people actually don't like Trump and would quite happily have Pence as president. You know, and Pence would not be any better on the issues, but I would rather have him with his hand on the button.
Let's go to a few more calls. Let's hear from Mike in San Francisco. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show.
How you doing? First of all, I was a supporter of Bernie Sanders, and following that, I voted for the Green Party. I just wanted to comment on the caller before about the election, you know, voting machines. I think this is one of the fallacies that's been put forth by the Democratic Party, along with the business about Russian interference. They're talking about Russian interference while the United States has CIA and has overthrown governments all over the world over the last 40 years or longer. So, I mean, that whole thing is just, I mean, the Democratic Party is killing themselves. They have not, and the country now, I've traveled, you know, to places like Michigan and Pennsylvania, and I know those some of those communities. The situation in the country now is the worst I think it's ever been during my lifetime, and I'm over 70 years old. So the Democratic Party is not responding one iota. They're just off in some, Trump is terrible, but the Democrats are just as bad. That's my main argument.
Well, thank you, Mike. We'll get a response in just a minute, but we have a related comment from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, Greg. Yes.
Well, there's several things. One is, I don't know what you attribute voter apathy to in the United States. There's probably dozens of reasons. That's a huge issue. The other thing is, and I guess following up on what your previous caller mentioned, and it's this. The Democrats have not produced for the people who need to vote Democratic to get real change in this country. I mean, if the Democrats had really laid out a program in the state of California or nationally, which really appealed to people who are disenfranchised, to poor people, to middle class people, to working class people. I think they'd find that they'd get support, but they haven't done that. They haven't produced, and I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of people are apathetic, because they don't see what's the point in voting for a Democrat. They're not going to do anything for us. So that's one thing. The last thing is the same thing on the issue with regard to Russia interfering in the United States elections. I used to trust Frontline, and they had a documentary on this week on Putin's involvement in the elections in the United States. And I was absolutely amazed at the spin that Frontline was taking on this, because you've got more to fear from Kobach and their group of people interfering in the elections in this country than you do from Putin, as far as I'm concerned. So to me, it's a red herring. I mean, people should be focusing on what's going on in this country by the people in this country rather than Putin. So that's my opinion.
All right. Thanks, Greg.
I would agree that we need to focus on voter suppression in this country. There's no argument there, but I don't think that means that we should look away from what may have happened with Russian interference. I don't have the answers on that, but if you look at some of the investigations so far, there were certainly some fishy things going on. especially involving Facebook and social media. And there was a concerted effort on the part of the Russians to buy ads and to help micro-target, in my view. And you have to also give credit to the Trump campaign. They were doing this on their own. So I think it is something that we should investigate. I think that the various congressional investigations should continue. Perhaps they'll find nothing, but I don't think it should be simply dismissed as a red herring, because there were definitely some shady things going on. And I think that certainly the Democratic Party may be using this to score political points, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't investigate it and look into it, because if indeed there was manipulation going on, that is a cause for concern, in the same way that voter suppression is a cause for concern, and in the same way that if there is a problem with our voting machines and they're vulnerable to hacking, that's something that we should be worried about and trying to correct through policy.
Thank you, Greg. Let's go next to Phil in New Mexico. Hi, Phil. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. My take on this is, as somebody who has dual nationality, and I voted in both the French and the American presidential elections, and needless to say, I wasn't thrilled with the choices in either. And one thing that I think goes to the point that the author has made, and I'd just like to amplify it, and you can call it, if you will, the Bernie Sanders critique, and that is that since the late 1980s, early 1990s, with the new Democrats under Clinton here, new Labor under Blair, and then what you've had in France under Hollande and even under Sarkozy, basically the working class voters have had no champions. The labor union voters have had no champions. That the neoliberalism that Tom Franks has done such a great job documenting in this country has left these workers who used to traditionally vote left saying to themselves, well, if the left-wing party is as bad as the right-wing party, then the hell with you all, and I'm going to listen to whoever comes along and panders to me. And personally, my great fear is not Trump, and it is not Marine Le Pen. My great fear is that, assuming that both Trump and Le Pen and everybody else fail to make the economic situation any better, and that the economies continue to degrade, that we will get real demagogues in the next election. Yeah. The true evil people that could do everything that we're afraid of about Trump.
Thank you, Phil.
Yeah, thanks, Phil, for that comment. I think that's very insightful, and it's also interesting to hear from someone who voted in both of those elections and follows politics in both countries. I think you're right, and this is one of the central arguments of my book, is that advanced liberal democracies can erode and fall apart if nativist populist leaders who don't have a democratic agenda come to power, that they will seek to erode the institutions that make our societies democratic. And we've already seen some gestures in that direction from Trump and Le Pen, talking about Trump's attack on judges and the independent judiciary, when he said during the travel ban debate in January that if more terrorists and bad people come into this country, it'll be the fault of these judges. Le Pen has called for ending birthright citizenship in France, which is a foundational part of French citizenship law. You see similar attacks in this country. Republicans talking about anchor babies and trying to roll back the idea of birthright citizenship. These are core constitutional values at the center of these countries and what they stand for. And I think that the risk is that as politicians who don't necessarily care about constitutional democracy come to power, they will roll back some of these protections. And I think we have to distinguish between simple majoritarianism, which is what a lot of these populists want. They think if they have 50% plus one vote, they can do whatever they want. And they're not interested in constitutional niceties, and they're not interested in independent judiciaries, and they're not interested in minority protections and all of the checks and balances that are built into liberal democratic states. They're majoritarians, and they feel that if they win one more vote than 50%, they can do whatever they want. And I think, as the caller was saying, the real danger is a new generation of populists will come along, or the current one will simply pick away at the institutions that make our societies democratic. And ultimately, that is the real threat.
What about Phil's comment about how neoliberalism has really been such a huge factor? And now, when you look at this global economy, you are seeing so much concentrated wealth and massive, massive inequality. You know, here, a lot of people said that Bernie Sanders was, you know, off the rails in the media. They called him the grandpa who's socialist or whatever. And so many Europeans say, well, in Europe, he would actually be center-right. His policies are actually not that radical. But what about the left in these countries, France, Germany, and Holland? Do they have strength? Do they have mass appeal? I mean, what is their major platform?
They don't. And they've essentially disappeared either by caving in to the demands of the populist right or simply losing voters because they don't have an agenda that appeals. As one of the other callers was saying, that the workers and the working class union members don't feel like they have a champion anymore. And when Marine Le Pen talks the way that she does in that passage that I read, then they find a new champion in these far-right parties. And so if you look, for instance, at Holland, the Dutch Labor Party, which used to be the country's biggest party, and even when they weren't in power, were one of the biggest parties, is down to under 10 seats in parliament now. They lost about 80% of their representation in the last election. And that went in all directions, some of it far-right, some of it to the Greens, some of it to other left-wing parties. In Germany, the Social Democrats lost to Merkel. And some of their votes have gone to the Greens. Some of them have gone to the new far-right party. Same thing just happened in the Austrian election. And in Denmark, the Social Democrats have lost a lot of votes to the Danish People's Party. And they've won a few of them back by adopting some of the anti-immigration rhetoric of the Danish People's Party. But they're not nearly as strong as they used to be. And so I think most of these countries are seeing a decline on the center-left. And there hasn't really been a strong replacement for what those parties used to represent. They haven't figured it out. And so what's happening is, if there's any challenge on a moral level to some of these xenophobic policies, it's coming from new center-left and green parties. So in Germany and Holland, you see the Greens doing quite well in the last elections. There's some other small parties that are sort of center-left but take a strong stance against the nativist populists, and that resonates with some voters who are angry about all of the xenophobia that they're hearing in public debate. But it's not coming from the parties that we think of as the center-left in Europe. And you're right that Bernie Sanders would be a centrist in Holland or France. People find him completely unremarkable.
That's so wild. What about the media there? Does anything strike you about how the media in these countries cover these issues?
I actually think that the media deserves some blame for the rise of these populist parties, in the sense that there was an attempt to sideline, an understandable attempt to sideline these voices and these parties and not report on them. And I think that that actually fueled some of the anger among the voters who ended up voting for them. I believe that these parties have dangerous ideas that would take these countries back decades, if not centuries, and put them in a very dark and dangerous place. But I don't believe that they should be completely silenced and shut down. I think that they should be defeated through force of argument in the public square. And I think what happened in places like Germany is, for so long that they were sidelined or sort of put on mute and completely silenced, that they were able to actually gain support by saying, look, we're being swept under the rug, they're muzzling us, no one's listening to us. And that actually helped build support for them. I think it's actually much more effective to let them spout their nativist xenophobic propaganda and then to fight them through debating them and showing that they are addressing some real problems, but their solutions are fake, and that they're actually going to take these countries back and to a very dangerous place.
What is the state of social movements in these countries?
There are social movements that have emerged to challenge a lot of these parties. There have been impressive grassroots social movements to help and assist refugees coming into the countries, especially in late 2015. You saw a sort of organic movement in Germany to help the refugees who were arriving. So I think civil society has certainly stepped up on some level, but it hasn't really been channeled politically in a coherent way. And so there's some interesting and important things happening on the ground, but it hasn't really found a political expression. And the far right has been much more effective in organizing angry people at the grassroots level and translating that into votes.
Given that, when you talk to activists on the ground, what is most effective? We have an email from Art who says, what are the top three things we can do to turn things around?
That's a hard one. I would say the first thing is for politicians who reject this agenda to speak out forcefully and directly and to reject the fear-mongering that these politicians are engaging in. And there are very few who have actually done this. As I said before, most of them are just caving in or mimicking the rhetoric of the far right because they're afraid of losing votes to them. Merkel has been quite impressive on this in the sense that she just didn't cave into it. She defended her policy. She said, yes, I may have made some mistakes, but we're going to manage. And in France, Macron did the same thing. In the final presidential debate with Le Pen, he sat straight across from her, like we're sitting right now, and said, you are the high priestess of fear. And that was a vicious debate. The entire country was watching. And he really pushed back, and he called her out for what she was doing. And I think people appreciated that. And it might simply be political symbolism, but I think that that is one step. And I think the other thing is for people, whether it's journalists or other politicians, to call them out and show that if the laws and policies that they're putting forward were actually put in place, this would not work. It would not solve any of the problems. And if anything, it would lead to the erosion of democracy in these countries.
Sasha Polakow-Saransky is an Open Society Foundations Fellow and author of the new book, Go Back to Where You Came From, The Backlash Against Immigration and the Fate of Western Democracy. He'll be speaking right after the show at noon at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, 110 The Embarcadero. Sasha, thanks for joining us. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll speak with McClatchy's Ben Weider about why the United Arab Emirates is paying the Steve Bannon-linked Cambridge Analytica $330,000 for a social media campaign against Qatar. We'll also be joined by San Francisco journalist Joe Eskenazi. He'll talk about his SF Public Press cover story. It examines how thousands of people remain homeless while rooms in SRO hotels remain vacant. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us.